British explorer Frank Smythe almost became the first person to ascend Mount Everest in 1933. He missed it by 1,000 feet, as he described it, at the very boundary of life and death. At 26,000 feet, climbers reach what they call the dead zone. There's not enough oxygen to keep humans alive, and during that expedition, almost all the other climbers never made it past the summit's base camp. But Frank Smythe carried on alone. In his diary, he recounted how, at one point on the ascent, he reached into his pocket to pull out a slab of a Kendall mint cake. He broke it in half and turned around to give the other half to a companion. But there was no one there. Here's what he wrote.
All the time that I was climbing alone, I had a strong feeling that I was accompanied by a second person. The feeling was so strong that it completely eliminated all loneliness I might otherwise have felt.
This is a phenomenon scientists call the third man factor. John Geiger spent 5 years tracking down the stories of people who've experienced it. His new book is called The Third Man Factor, Surviving the Impossible, and he joins us from Toronto. John Geiger, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
First, can you give us a clear definition of what the third man phenomenon is?
It's a sense of an unseen being, a presence that intervenes at critical moments when people are under great stress or in life-and-death type struggles to provide companionship, a sense of help, aid, encouragement, just a generalized benevolent intervention from a seemingly outside source, a being that's not seen but is felt.
You trace the term third man factor to Ernest Shackleton's almost disastrous expedition in Antarctica that began in 1914.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the great survival stories in history. Shackleton and his men were trapped in the ice in the Weddell Sea and were forced to abandon their ship, Endurance, which was crushed by the ice. They dragged their small boats across rotting ice for many months, and some of the men became suicidal. It was just an absolutely horrific ordeal. They finally were able to launch those boats in the South Polar Sea, and they made it to Elephant Island. Most of the men remained behind, and Shackleton took a small party and crossed over hundreds of miles to South Georgia, which is a British possession in the South Atlantic, and there was a whaling station there. He reached the island in the midst of a hurricane, this absolutely horrific crossing. They then had to cross this mountain range, which was uncharted, and it was during that final part of this absolutely unbelievable escape from Antarctica that Shackleton and two other men each felt that there was actually a fourth presence, that there was what Shackleton termed a divine companion who accompanied them on that last leg of that journey when they really were at the point of collapse. And later on, T.S. Eliot, a great American poet, altered the number for some reason, poetic license, altered the number from 4 to 3 in The Wasteland, you know, probably the greatest poem of the 20th century, and in The Wasteland, so it becomes who is the third who walks beside you. So that's where the term third man factor comes from. It's really originally Shackleton via T.S. Eliot.
You collected stories from mountain climbers, explorers, prisoners of war, and there's one story from a survivor from the World Trade Center on 9/11, Ron DeFrancesco. He was the last one to leave the South Tower, I believe, before it collapsed. Can you tell us a story?
Well, yeah, Ron was a money market trader, and he was above, working above the point of impact. You know, found himself, like many other people, trapped above that point. Initially, he had tried to go down, but the stairwell he found himself in was blocked by debris, and there was a tremendous amount of smoke coming up. So he got to this landing just above the impact point, and people were collapsed on that landing. Some of them apparently unconscious. Others were sobbing, kind of given up, I guess. And Ron was there, and he suddenly felt on intervention. He felt that there was someone else joined him on the landing. He heard a voice which gave him very specific directions. You know, Ron, you can survive this. You'll get out of this. You got to keep going down. And he literally felt like he was led, and he was led towards the flames and towards the smoke, and ended up fighting his way through debris, covering his head as best he could with his arms against the flames, and fought his way down and got through this after a few minutes and found himself in a lit stairwell. Everything appeared to resume to normal below the impact point, and he carried on down and and was able to, he passed some firefighters coming down, was able to get out just before the building, or just as the building was collapsing. You know, he felt very strongly that an angel, he's a Roman, practicing Roman Catholic, and he felt that an angel had intervened to save his life.
In this idea of a guardian angel, is there a sort of a religious aspect to this phenomenon?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that really what we're talking about is the same thing. I think that the third man factor is a manifestation of what historically and for people of faith would be a guardian angel. So there are a number of places in the Bible, of course, where guardian angels make their appearance, and often they're in very similar situations to some of the harrowing survival stories that I include in the book. So clearly there is a religious or spiritual explanation to this phenomenon, and either this book I think is proof of the existence of guardian angels, or if you're a religious person or if you're not, I think it shows that the guardian angel experience is based on mental processes, and that in fact many skeptics and non-believers have also had this experience, and they attribute it to other explanations. And there certainly is some very interesting science behind this as well.
There is actually research being done looking at this, that it may actually be a necessary human instinct, a survival instinct.
It certainly is looking like that. There has been some very interesting work done in Switzerland by neurologists who, using a electrical stimulus, have actually provoked a third man type response, and at least a sense of a presence. And they remove the electrical stimulus, and the presence would disappear, and then place it back, and suddenly the presence returned. But in that case, what was interesting is the patient didn't feel that it was a helpful or benevolent presence. It was simply, there's someone here with me now. But no sort of sense that this person had any agenda to help. And that's what's interesting. That's the difference. And certainly no science has yet been able to explain how that kind of that sense of presence. So there is a part of our brain that seems to be involved in our self-perception, where we are in our environment, may have a role in this, but it doesn't explain how that transforms into this absolutely compelling, benevolent, force for survival. And that's the part of the puzzle that's critical, I think,
John Geiger's new book is called The Third Man Factor, Surviving the Impossible. John Geiger, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
In April of 2004, Pat Tillman died on a treeless hillside in Afghanistan as he crouched behind some low boulders. The former NFL star turned Army Ranger was heard screaming, "What are you shooting at? I'm Pat Tillman." We now know he was killed in a barrage of friendly fire, but it took more than a month for the Army to acknowledge that fact. The story of Pat Tillman's life and the cover-up of how he died are told in a new book by John Krakauer, the author of Into Thin Air and Into the Wild. On that day in 2004, Pat Tillman's platoon was split in two. He was in the first convoy, which drove through a deep, narrow canyon. His younger brother, Kevin, was following behind in the second convoy when they were ambushed.
It was like Star Wars, one of the soldiers said. It was just all these tracer rounds, all these bullets flying, RPGs, mortars. And Pat's group looked back and immediately realized that the other half of the platoon was being attacked.
Being attacked by Afghan fighters.
That's right, by tribal insurgents working for the Taliban.
You describe Pat Tillman here. He knows his brother is back behind him. They're getting fired on. He sprints out. He apparently says to his fellow ranger, "Let's go help our boys."
That's right. And you have to know, Pat and Kevin, the two brothers, were extremely close. I mean, this is a tight family all the way around. But Pat and Kevin, as one soldier put it, were joined at the hip.
Describe what happens when the back half of the platoon comes out of the canyon and start firing on the position where Pat Tillman is up on the hill. What happened? What were they thinking?
When they exited the canyon, they paused for maybe 30 seconds. By this point, Pat was in the boulders right above them. And Pat and another young private with him named Brian O'Neill reported later that, they were shooting at us at first, but it seemed like no big deal. Then there was this lull. And then all of a sudden, when they got back in their Humvee and started moving, the area where Pat and O'Neill were just got hammered, just sprayed by this furious fusillade of everything, all kinds of machine guns. What had happened was that with Tillman and O'Neill was an Afghan militia fighter named Syed Farhad. He had been firing suppressive fire up on the opposite canyon wall to prevent the enemy, if there were any left, from shooting down at the second half. The leader of this particular Humvee, out of the corner of his eye, he saw muzzle flashes. He saw that they were coming from a bearded guy with an AK-47. He testified that the guy had on an American uniform. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the panic of the moment, he reflexively put the guy in the sights of his M4 and put 7 rounds into his chest.
And he thought the Afghan was looking at him and firing at him.
He thought the Afghan was the enemy. What then happened is that all the other soldiers in that Humvee started firing their machine guns and M4s at that same place because they're trained to shoot where their team leader shoots. They're also trained, though, to identify their targets, positively identify your targets. None of them did that. Actually, the driver of that Humvee looked up and saw that they were Americans. He realized, wait, those are our guys. He yelled and tried to get people to stop, but he was a split second too late.
The Rangers who were on that hill knew immediately that this was friendly fire. There was no question. But the story, obviously, we know now, that emerged from the Pentagon was very different right away.
Yeah, and it's not just the soldiers on the ground who were there knew it was friendly fire. People from headquarters started arriving within a few hours. And every one of them, including the lieutenant colonel who was in charge of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, all of them immediately understood that it was friendly fire and acknowledged as much. I mean, it's not like anyone ever doubted it. And yet, within hours, certainly, and probably less, the Ranger Regiment and officers, high-ranking officers back in the States, were conspiring to cover this up. There's no other way to put it. The Army to this day denies it, but it's just, it defies belief. They immediately, by sworn testimony, started putting in a recommendation for a Silver Star Medal. That never happens, especially if you know that the soldier in question was killed by friendly fire. And then they did this astonishing series of things that puts a lie to their expressed, you know, desire to tell the truth. They burned, like when a soldier is killed in combat, you should put, you know, his uniform, his weapon, everything, anything that can be considered forensic evidence should be sent back to the States with a body so the medical examiners can determine the cause of death. In the case of Tillman, none of that happened. His uniform was burned. His body armor was burned. His weapon disappeared. His helmet disappeared. Part of his brain that was found on the ground disappeared. The Army intentionally lied to the medical examiners. They knowingly, deliberately lied and said he was killed by the Taliban, which really perplexed the guys who did the autopsy. They just broke regulation after regulation. They admonished Pat's platoon mates not to tell a soul. About the only person in the platoon by the first or second day who didn't know it was friendly fire was Pat's brother, Kevin, because everyone was told, don't tell Kevin what happened. They sent one of Pat and Kevin's best friend, this young guy named Russell Bear, to fly back to the States with Kevin and the body. And Russell Bear was ordered not to tell Kevin anything about what happened. In no uncertain terms, he was told he would be severely punished if he did. So he hardly said a word to Kevin on the flight back. But then during the memorial service, you know, he was invited by the parents afterwards to come to their home. And Bear was forced to lie to the mother, to her face, after handing her this flag that had been folded over Pat's casket. And he was so upset by having to lie to Pat's mother that Russell Bear went AWOL.
John Krakauer, there have been so many investigations now of how Pat Tillman died. There was congressional inquiry. Pat Tillman's mother wrote her own book. How did you deal with everything that was known already? How did you come to terms with trying to make something new or discover something new in this story?
Well, even to this day, there's a lot that isn't known. I interviewed members of Pat's platoon who had not been interviewed before, and that was invaluable. I actually learned a lot that hasn't been known until now. So, you know, it's not like I felt like the story had been fully told. It still hasn't been fully told. I mean, you know, the commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, who I think is probably the best man for the job, nevertheless, he was as deeply involved in the cover-up as anyone. You know, he signed off on what he knew was a falsified recommendation for a Silver Star. He apologized for that, but he hasn't come clean about much else. He hasn't revealed his involvement or who he spoke to or when he knew or if when Rumsfeld knew. I mean, so it's not like we know everything. We still don't.
John Krakauer, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Krakauer. His book is titled Where Men Win Glory, The Odyssey of Pat Tillman. At his confirmation hearing earlier this year, General McChrystal acknowledged that the Army had failed the Tillman family. I was a part of that, he said, and I apologize for it. But McChrystal also said he didn't see any activities by anyone to deceive and that Pat Tillman absolutely earned the Silver Star.
Deep into Dan Brown's new novel, The Lost Symbol, Harvard symbologist Robert Langdon gives a crash course on the number 33. Pythagoras, Genesis, Joseph, Jesus, Islam, and the Masons, they're all in there, and they're all in there throughout the entire book. Langdon, of Da Vinci Code fame, is back, uncovering esoteric mysteries even as he skeptically dismisses them. And by completely rational coincidence, Dan Brown is in our New York bureau at the very moment that I mentioned your name and your new book. Astonishing.
Nice to be here.
Good to talk with you. What do you think is the attraction that hidden wisdom holds for people in this age when you can Google just about any wisdom you want?
You know, I think people love to learn, and I think people like to see the world they live in through a different lens, and that's really what these books do. They show you something that you might think you know about, something like Washington, D.C., or the church, or symbols. And you get to see them through the lens of a specialist who has a slightly different take on things.
A symbologist.
Yes.
Is he in the Department of Symbology, by the way? I can never understand that.
I think if this were the real world, he'd be in a Department of Semiotics.
I see.
But this is the fictional world, and he is in the Department of Symbology.
You find that the discipline of symbology has more legs than
semiotics?
Than semiotics,
I think so.
Robert Langdon is somebody who keeps on bumping into these hidden secrets, this lost wisdom, but he doesn't exactly believe in them, I gather.
He is a skeptic, and despite what you may believe, I'm something of a skeptic as well. And I think one of the reasons these books have found a mass appeal is that he is skeptical. He's diving into these conspiracy theories from the standpoint of somebody who doesn't believe them. And so you can be an intelligent reader and say, well, I'm sort of interested in this, but I really doubt it's real. And at every point, Langdon is right there with you doubting it's real.
Does Professor Langdon, does he get a new and different, very attractive woman, and perhaps intellectually gifted or descended from Mary Magdalene, whatever it might be, for every story? Or does he, you know, is there ever going to be any permanence in this man's life?
He is a blessed man in many ways, I guess.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's funny. I love building tension into novels, and certainly having a female traveling companion, there's always a romantic and sexual tension. Even if it's not on the page, it's implied. I love the idea of smart women. I find that very attractive, and obviously Langdon does too.
Super smart women in this case. I mean, you know, world-class noeticists.
Well, as I said, he's a fortunate guy.
Okay. To say that they've reached a large audience is an understatement. You are a super best-selling novelist, and The Da Vinci Code, of course, was made into a hugely successful film. How does that change the way you write a book, now that you are not just Dan Brown, but the Dan Brown?
You know, it's funny. I don't think it changes at all. I still get up every morning at 4 a.m. I write 7 days a week, including Christmas, and I still face a blank page every morning. And my characters don't really care how many books I've sold.
And if you're going to write about Washington, do you spend a lot of time in Washington walking around and doing field trips to see where everything is?
Oh, without a doubt. I first saw Washington as a young kid. I think it was 9 or so. I was fascinated with the museums. And as I, you know, grew up and had a fascination for art and architecture, you know, it is the great American city when it comes to art and architecture. And one of the luxuries of having written the Da Vinci Code is that I, you know, had access to all sorts of specialists in Washington who were very, very generous to open up the doors of some of these monuments and museums and great structures and give me behind-the-scenes tours. That was very exciting.
Your father, I've read, was a mathematician or a math teacher, certainly.
He is, and also a math textbook author.
And did he introduce you to magic squares and things like Fibonacci series and casting nines? Was that part of your childhood?
It sure was. On Christmas morning, when we were little kids, he would create treasure hunts through the house with different limericks or mathematical puzzles that led us to the next clue. And so for me, at a young age, treasure hunts were always exciting.
And a treasure hunt is not a very far-fetched metaphor for a Dan Brown novel nowadays.
No, that's, I think you hit it right on the head.
Pretty literally. So in writing The Lost Symbol, did you begin with a whole schematic of puzzles that get solved and the sort of building the puzzle first and then writing the story around it? Does the puzzle get created as you go along with the story?
Or it really depends on the puzzle and on the moment in the story. At least all of my novels begin with a big idea. And in this case, having written Angels and Demons, I'd studied some particle mm-hmm. physics and knew that there was this world of noetic science that was kind of out there. And it really had no relation to Angels and Demons, but I knew I wanted to come back to it. And in the 10 years that, between Angels and Demons and now, that field has exploded, and I became very, very interested with it. So that really is this idea of a science that's tied to these ancient mysteries, the old and the new. I love to tie together. And the codes, they serve a plot line.
In this book, Freemasonry figures, to say it figures prominently is an understatement. This book is about Freemasonry and Freemasons. What's your sensitivity to a group that, over the centuries, taken some pretty rough beatings for keeping its secrets? They were vilified by Hitler during his day.
Sure.
How sensitive are you to Masonic sensibilities?
Oh, highly sensitive. I mean, there's a point in the book where Langdon makes the point that misinterpreting people's symbols is often the root of prejudice. And part of what I hoped to do with this book is shed some light from my perspective on Masonic symbolism and Masonic ritual.
But Professor Langdon says, don't read anything evil into Masonic secrets. But he's always being proven wrong all the time. The world is always much more mysterious than he says it is at first blush.
That is true, and that's one of the things that fascinates me about Freemasonry.
What is it that fascinates you about Freemasonry?
Well, we live in a world where people kill each other every day over whose definition of God is correct. And here is a worldwide organization that at its core will bring people together from many, many different religions and ask only that you believe in a God, and they'll all stand in the same room and proclaim their reverence for a God. And it seems like a perfect blueprint for a universal spirituality.
It sounds like your next novel is going to be about Alcoholics Anonymous.
I haven't had the pleasure, but I guess if I follow in the footsteps of other authors, maybe someday.
There's always the world of public radio as well. We have numbers for stations and strange initials for things. So
the NPR code. That's my next novel.
NPR code. Okay. Dan Brown, thanks a lot for talking with us about your new novel, The Lost Symbol.
My pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt from the novel, which is out today at npr.org. Tomorrow, we'll visit the headquarters of Scottish Rite Masonry here in Washington, D.C. That building is the setting for the first scene in The Lost Symbol, and we'll talk to some real Masons.
We made the very radical statement that men of different religions can agree that God exists, they can agree that God compels them to do good in the community, and then they can stop talking about religion.
More on Masons and Masonic myths on tomorrow's program.